You're listening to Shameless Potpourri with Joe Heschmeyer, a production of Catholic Answers.
Welcome back to Shameless Potpourri. My name is Joe Heschmeyer, and I want to explore a pretty simple question. Was the Virgin Mary an unwed mother? With Christmas around the corner, there's a decent chance you'll even hear someone preach on this subject. And the problem is, almost everybody who talks about it gets it wrong because they don't understand the Jewish cultural context. For instance, here's Sister Didi Byrne at the Republican National Convention in 2020 talking about the unborn being among the least of these we have to care about, but then tying this message in to the Virgin Mary allegedly being an unwed mother.
And while we tend to think of the marginalized as living beyond our borders, the truth is the largest marginalized group in the world can be found here in the United States. They are the unborn. As Christians, we first met Jesus as a stirring embryo in the womb of an unwed mother and saw him born 9 months later in the poverty of the cave.
Look, it's a powerful image to think about Jesus being born of an unwed mother. And I think maybe for that reason, we have trouble resisting it, even though it's not actually true. I'll give a few more examples. Lisa Bevery, in her book Fight Like a Girl, says Mary exchanged the uncertainty and shame of being an unwed mother for the surety of God's promise. She exchanged her fears for God's favor. Reverend Larry Pickens likewise says the story of Jesus' birth represents the experience of a poor unwed mother and her mate, searching for a place to have her baby in the midst of poverty and displacement. It's hard to imagine that from these humble conditions, the Prince of Peace is born. And look, by all means, we should absolutely have compassion on the poor, on the unborn, on those in difficult circumstances, including unwed mothers. And Jesus coming in humble circumstances is a good reminder of all of that. But it doesn't follow that Jesus is born of an unwed mother. He's not. I understand why people think he is, though, because there are a few passages in the New Testament that are really difficult to translate and that give us these strangely divergent translations. Let me give you two examples of what I'm talking about. In Matthew chapter 1, verse 18, Matthew introduces us to the story of how Jesus' birth comes about. And in one translation, the NIV, says that his mother Mary was pledged to be married to Joseph. Okay, that's some kind of agreement to get married. The KJV, though, says Mary was espoused to Joseph, which makes it sound like they're already married. The NLT and others say that Mary was engaged to be married, which sounds like they have some kind of modern engagement like what we have here in the 21st century. The NKJV says she was betrothed to Joseph. Now, all four of those descriptions seem like different, not just synonyms. Those are different relationships. If you don't know if your significant other is your girlfriend or your fiance or your wife, you're going to be in trouble. Well, likewise, when we get to how Mary describes the relationship, it's also very confusing. This is Luke chapter 1, verse 34. In some translations, Mary says, "How will this be, seeing I do not know a husband?" Others, "Since I am a virgin." Others, "Since I have no relations with a man." Still others, confusingly and just outright incorrectly, "How can this be, seeing that I have no husband?" Now, this one, there's actually an easier answer. What Mary says is pretty clear in the Greek. "How can this be, seeing that I know not man?" She's saying she's not in a sexual relationship. She's not saying that she's unmarried. And those two are different ideas. You can be in one and not the other. We're used to seeing people in sexual relationships who aren't married. Today we're going to see a married couple that's not in a sexual relationship. But there's one more passage just to add to we might call the biblical confusion here. I mentioned Matthew 1 verse 18 earlier, where it says Mary was betrothed or engaged or espoused or pledged to Joseph. But then the next line is before they came together. So we've got one point of confusion. What is that word? Is it betrothed? Is it espoused? What does it mean? And then we have a second confusion. Before they came together, what does that mean? Is this a sexual euphemism? Does this mean something else? We're going to see it means something else. And then in the next verse, it says Mary was found to be with child of the Holy Spirit and her husband, Joseph. Okay, now we've got a little more clarity. This isn't her fiancé. This isn't her boyfriend. This is her husband. being a just man and unwilling to put her to shame, resolved to send her away quietly. Now, as you may guess, that's a reference to divorce. In Matthew 19, verse 7, they asked Jesus, why did Moses command one to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away? And so putting someone away is a reference to getting divorced from them. Now, you don't end a dating relationship or even an engagement with a divorce. And so we have some clear indications from Matthew 1, verse 19, that Joseph is actually Mary's husband at the time the angel Gabriel comes. And that's why he's considering divorce. Now, I mentioned three different times where Mary's referred to as an unwed mother. You can find a lot more. I wanted to save this one for a couple of reasons. One, I don't want it to seem like I'm picking on this. It's a senior pastor by the name of Tom Moody. And he's not a prominent enough person to feel good about, you know, firing at him. Because he's not like a big Protestant celebrity or anything like that. But he gives a pretty characteristic homily about, or sermon about Mary being an unwed mother. But he ends up honing in on a really important dimension. If Mary were really an unwed mother, we would expect there to be a tremendous amount of outcry because Jesus is under a lot of public scrutiny. So here's how Moody puts it.
Two could not escape this idea, this public scrutiny. They're going to look at everything he's ever done. They're going to look at everything he's ever done on the internet, on the Facebook, everything. They're going to look at everything, and something that they can find might be considered as scandalous will be used against him. Well, what can there be in Jesus' background? Nothing as far as the Christ is concerned, but the Jesus was born from an unwed mother. That could be a huge disgrace. It could mean stoning for adultery, because it is quite obvious, the obvious thing here, I'm speaking literally now, the obvious thing here is that Mary has committed adultery. I mean, hey, you can come with this virgin thing all you want to, but I know the facts of life. And though you've obviously, and so you're obviously guilty.
There's a lot of really strange things about Pastor Moody's sermon there, the seeming distinction between Jesus and the Christ, a lot of things that were kind of unusual. But the thing that I think really jumps out is something that he gets right or close to right, because he says, you know, Jesus is under a microscope. He's got a lot of public enemies, and they're looking for anything to kind of trip him up or anything that might, you know, smell like a scandal. So far, so good. He's also right that if Jesus was conceived out of wedlock, that would be a scandal. Now, he actually underestimates how big of a scandal that would be. He's thinking it's a scandal for Mary. You know, she could get stoned for adultery. This would also be a scandal for Jesus. Deuteronomy chapter 23 says that no bastard shall enter the assembly of the Lord, even to the 10th generation. And so if you're going to claim that Jesus is conceived out of wedlock, you're not just saying Mary's an unwed mother, you're also saying Jesus is a bastard. And just as people wouldn't be quick to excuse Mary on the grounds of the virgin conception and birth, neither are they likely to excuse Jesus. So if Jesus really were conceived out of wedlock, the one place we would expect not to find him is in the temple, because he wouldn't be allowed in the temple. And yet in Matthew 26, in the Garden of Gethsemane, when they arrest Jesus, what does he say? Day after day, I sat in the temple teaching and you did not seize me. In fact, even when Jesus's paternity is called into question, it's really remarkable. Origen points this out in Contra Celsum, that the rumor against Christians is that Jesus isn't really born of a virgin, but neither is he actually a product of Joseph and Mary. Rather, Mary had been guilty of adultery with a certain Roman soldier named Panthera. Why does that matter? Because why do they have to make up the lie about Panthera? Because if Jesus had been born of Joseph and Mary, there would be no scandal. And the reason there would be no scandal, the reason that Jesus could go into the temple, is because at the time that Mary becomes pregnant, she is legally married to Joseph. Let's find out how. Jewish weddings at this time had two stages. Now, technically, they still have two stages, but now they're two stages in a single rite, so it happens all at the same time. In the old days, these two stages were separated by 3 months or even a year. I'll get into why that is in a minute, but before I explain kind of the timing and the reason behind it, let's just introduce you to some of the main terms in question here. Anita Diament, in her book The New Jewish Wedding, which is, as you might imagine, about Jewish wedding customs, says that although some elements are much older, the Jewish wedding began to take its current shape during the 11th century. Before that, marriage was accomplished in two distinct rituals, separated by as much as a year. Remember that thing. So you've got these two parts of the wedding. They're now two parts of the same wedding day. They used to be not the same day. They were as much as a year apart. The first was the betrothal, or erusin, also called kedushin. Comes from the word kadosh, meaning holy. After their betrothal, the bride and groom were considered legally wed. And a get, the formal bill of divorce, was necessary to dissolve the contract. So notice that. This is not like what you might imagine when you hear the word betrothal. It's not a pledge to marry. It's not an engagement. It's something deeper than that. It's a contractual, binding, legal relationship in which the two of you actually become man and wife. That's why, A, there's a lot of difficulty in translating this concept in Matthew 1, verse 18, because we don't really have an equivalent concept in the way we do marriages today. And two, why Jesus is able to go into the temple, because he's not illegitimate. A child born here is a child born to a married father and mother. But this is just the first of the two stages. As Diament explains, even so, the marriage was not consummated until the next ceremony, nisuin, or nuptials. Now, you might hear that and think, okay, well, it sounds like they can't have relationships. They can't have any marital relations because it hasn't been consummated. Well, you're still reading too much of modern marriage practice into the ancient Jewish wedding. As Rabbi Naftali Silberberg explains in a Shabbat.org article, he says, according to Torah law, marriage is a two-step process. The first stage is called Kedushin, and the second step is known as Nisuin. We already got all that, right? Kedushin is commonly translated as betrothal, but it actually renders the bride and groom full-fledged husband and wife. After this point, if God forbid they decide to part ways, a get, a Jewish divorce, would be required. However, he says, the bride and groom are not permitted to live together as husband and wife until the second stage, the Nisuin, is completed. That's the key to this whole puzzle. In the old days, so go back to the first century or really any time before a pretty modern era, and young men, when they would go to get married, often wouldn't have established themselves in such a way they already have their own house or anything like this. They weren't bachelor pads and the like. So a young man would be living and working at home. And only then would he leave the house after he got married. Now, this creates a problem. You don't just have, you know, giant subdivisions going up for sale. So the new groom has to go and prepare a place for his bride. This is why the length of time between the two stages differs. So, for instance, if the woman is living with her dad and he can take care of her, you've got a year. You can have a year to get everything in order, set up, and then the two of you move in together and you consummate the marriage, not by having sex. You consummate the marriage by moving houses together. And now you live fully and completely as husband and wife, and she's under your authority as her husband rather than under her father's authority. Now, I get people are going to object to that part, but that's the critical kind of transfer that happens, not the sex. The sex, as we're going to see, could be happening during the first stage. This is why they're full-fledged husband and wife, remember? That's going to be important later on. We'll see why. But just if you're imagining consummation means in Jewish wedding context what it means in a modern context, that's a mistake. The consummation is the coming together of the houses. And this is really important and really beautiful. Before I get there, I mentioned it's a year if the woman, you know, has her husband, or excuse me, has her father that she's still living under his roof. In the case of like a widow, you have like 3 months because she might need a place to stay much sooner. She needs someone to take care of her. And so you need time to get everything ready, but she needs you to speed it up. So that's kind of the compromise position. So there's different lengths of time depending on the circumstances, but the basic idea is that after you get married, your first duty as a husband is to prepare a place for your wife. One of the things that's so cool about this is it explains the relationship of Jesus and the church that we see in the New Testament. that we have to realize we are in between these two stages. Jesus is already the bridegroom of the church. The church is already his bride. We don't live together. As Jesus explains in John 14, in my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? And when I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and will take you to myself, that where I am, you may be also. I've always loved that passage, but once you realize that this is what a new groom does, it gives a whole deeper meaning. He's saying, look, you know the promises. If the church is the bride of Christ, as the New Testament says, the bridegroom is going to prepare a place to live with the bride forever. That's what a new bridegroom does. This also explains the seemingly contradictory ways that Jesus is referred to in the New Testament. Here's what I mean. In Matthew 9, verse 15, Jesus describes himself here and now as the bridegroom. He says, can the wedding guests mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them? The days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast. You might be saying, what is going on here? So the bridegroom is with them. They're having some kind of marital celebration, seemingly, and then the bridegroom isn't with them. And then jump forward to Matthew 25. The kingdom of heaven is like 10 maidens who are waiting with lighted lamps to meet the bridegroom. So the bridegroom was here and now he's gone and then he's coming back. Well, yeah, that's what happens in a Jewish wedding. They get legally married and then they don't just go live together. They actually separate so that he can go and prepare a place. And then the culmination is you move houses and, you know, you move her into your house. Or, you know, you both move into the new house. Revelation chapter 19, verse 7 describes this really well. Let us rejoice and exult and give him the glory, for the marriage of the Lamb has come and his bride has made herself ready. So we already are the bride of Christ, and yet there's also a not yet dimension to it, that in one way, we're already united with Jesus. In another way, this is going to be consummated, not in any weird way, in the coming together to live together. That's the second stage of the Jewish marriage. That's the Nisuin. Now, that's an important dimension for making sense of all the marital imagery in the New Testament about Jesus and the church. But this is also going to be really important for figuring out the dynamic of the Holy Family at Annunciation and at Christmas. Here's what I mean by that. Just as there's a two-stage wedding of Jesus and the church, there's a two-stage wedding of Joseph and Mary. And as you might guess, this is why we have so much trouble explaining how we can speak of them as kind of betrothed, kind of pledged, kind of engaged, but also as actually husband and wife. And also, you know, he's contemplating divorce. Well, because they're in the same kind of relationship. They've gotten through the first stage, the Kiddushin. They are legally married. They're full-fledged husband and wife. And yet, they don't yet live together. Now, when you have that kind of cultural context of how a wedding works, it makes sense of Matthew chapter 1. After Joseph has this dream with the angel, we're going to get back to it. We're told that he awoke from sleep. Then he took his wife, but knew her not until she had borne a son. Now, there's two expressions there that are confusing. One, took his wife. That might sound like a sexual euphemism. It's not. It's a reference to the second stage of the wedding. When it said he took his wife, he doesn't mean he had relations with his wife, because we're explicitly told in the next line, he knew her not until she had borne a son. Now, that second reference, knowing her not, that's like in Genesis chapter 4, when we read that Adam knew Eve and she conceived and bore Cain. That is a carnal kind of knowledge. That's a marital knowledge. But the moving in together is the first reference. So St. Matthew is saying that Mary and Joseph have completed, before the angel gets there, the first stage of the wedding. They're already legally married. Then there's a lot of things that happen. Mary conceives Jesus. She goes and spends 3 months with Elizabeth, and seemingly sometime after she comes back, Joseph has this dream because he's trying to figure out what he's supposed to do. Do I move forward with the second stage of the wedding, or do I get a legal divorce? He's told to move forward, and he does. But even when they consummate the marriage by moving in together, they're still not having sex. Now, there's that intel, and we're going to get into what that intel does and doesn't mean. But I want to just get that part clear. So when Joseph wakes up from the dream, he moves forward by inviting Mary in and they complete the very public dimension, the Nisuin. All of this is going to matter a lot in terms of Mary's strange reaction to the angel Gabriel's announcement, because she says, "How shall this be, seeing I know not a man?" So that's one place where if it says, "I have no husband," that's just a bad translation. She does have a husband, but she's telling the angel she can't fathom having a child with her husband because they're not having sex. And that is very strange. And a lot of people read this passage and assume, well, of course they're not having sex. They're only engaged. But they're not only engaged, right? We now know they're legally married. And what's more, they can be having sex with each other. Now, you'll hear conflicting claims on this. Some people will say, oh, they weren't allowed to during that first stage of the marriage. That is false. And we know that's false because the Jewish Talmud in Kiddushin 2a says a woman is acquired or betrothed to a man in three ways. Number one, through money, like dowry. Number two, through a document, you know, a marital contract. And number three, through sexual intercourse. So if an unmarried man and an unmarried woman had sex together, that's not fornication, that's marriage. They are no longer unmarried. This is clear in a couple places in the Bible. Genesis 24, this is actually how Isaac and Rebekah get married. Verse 67, Isaac brought her into the tent and took Rebekah, and she became his wife. There's no big ceremony. They just sleep together, and that's how they get married. St. Paul seems to also refer to this in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 16. He says, "Do you not know that he who joins himself to a prostitute becomes one body with her? For as it is written, the two shall become one." In other words, Paul seems to be saying that if you are unmarried and you fornicate with another unmarried woman, now you're no longer unmarried. You guys are married now. You two have become one flesh. That's how the Kiddushin can work. Now, later, for I guess obvious reasons, rabbis really discourage and even forbid this way of contracting marriage. So you can no longer do that today in a Jewish wedding. But that's an important cultural context. So not only could a couple in the first stage of marriage, because they're already fully fledged, legally wed, husband and wife, not only could they have sex, that's actually one way to enter the first stage of marriage. It doesn't enter the second stage of marriage, right? You can be sleeping together, but as long as you're living in separate houses, you haven't entered the second stage of marriage. Another place in the Talmud is Mishnah Yevamot 4:10, in which it talks about how, even if a woman is only in the first stage of marriage to a man, they've gone through the Kiddushin, they haven't gone to the Nisuin, and he dies, she has to wait at least 3 months before she marries someone else, including his brother, in what's called the Levirate marriage. This is so she can know who the father of her child is if it turns out she's pregnant. Now, notice that only makes sense if the previous husband, including one, they've only been through the first of the two stages, could potentially be the father of the child. Now, later you get Rabbi Yehuda who says, well, this is really not an issue except for betrothed women in the area of Judea due to the fact that the groom is familiar with her, that women in Judea were much more likely to be having children with men, that they were only in the first stage of marriage. Explains, the custom in Judea was for the couple to be secluded together before the marriage, so they would become familiar with each other. This led to the possibility they might cohabit even during the betrothal period. So all I'm saying there is Jesus is born in Bethlehem in Judea. And the idea that his parents might still be in the first stage of the wedding and not the second stage, there's no scandal, there's no moral issue attached to that. It doesn't even seem to raise an eyebrow. Now, you'll get all kinds of scholarly debate about whether, you know, Yehuda's writing 150, 200 years later, how well does he really know the situation on the ground? But it certainly appears by all the ancient sources that there are these two stages of marriage. One of the ways to enter the first stage is through sex, so you can definitely be having sex in the first stage of marriage. The thing you're not doing together is moving your houses together. You're not living together in a new place. Now, why does all this matter for Mary and Joseph? Go back to Mary's really strange response to the angel. He tells her, a married woman, that she's going to have a baby, and she is flabbergasted and says, how shall this be, seeing I know not man? That is a weird reaction that suggests there's something else going on here. Now, I'm going to get into what that something else is, but I want to first highlight Mary's response is very strange, but it doesn't end there. Matthew 1, as we already kind of saw, we're told that Joseph and Mary weren't having relations until she'd born a son. Well, why not? They're legally married. And in fact, he took his wife. They completed the second stage of the marriage. So even if you thought they couldn't during the first stage of the marriage, here they are in the second stage of the marriage, and they're still not having marital relations. What in the world is going on here? Unfortunately, a lot of Protestants are so focused on the word until, saying, oh, well, if it says until, they must have had relations after Christmas, that they don't stop to ask the more basic question, why were they not having relations before Christmas? Why were they not having relations before the angel Gabriel got there? Because it's easy to fall into the trap of thinking, oh, well, maybe they weren't having relations because Gabriel told them. Nope, we have no evidence of that. And that wouldn't explain why Mary is confused at the outset. They're already not having a sexual relationship when they could be back here. Then, for another 9 months, we see them not having a sexual relationship. Now, there's a good answer to that, and it has to do with why Protestants are wrong to think that they had relations after Christmas. But let's get into that why. So this is John MacArthur making a pretty standard, I think, Protestant case.
He kept her a virgin, by the way, until she gave birth to a son, which means that he didn't keep her a virgin after that. And that's clear in the New Testament, because Jesus had brothers and sisters born to Joseph and Mary, and they're named and referred to. She was not a perpetual virgin, and she was not immaculately conceived without sin. Those are fantasies of the Roman Catholic system. She had many other children, but not until after Jesus was born did Joseph come near her.
Now, this is a pretty standard Protestant argument, and it's not a good one for a few reasons. First, you cannot say the fact that Mary and Joseph didn't have relations until Jesus was born means they did after, because you use the word until in all kinds of ways, both in English and in Greek, that don't mean that. For instance, in 1 Corinthians 15:25, we're told that Christ must reign until he's put all his enemies under his feet. If you tell your kids, be good until I get back, you don't mean, I need you to be bad after I get back. Just like 1 Corinthians 15:25 doesn't mean once Christ has put all the enemies under his feet, he needs to stop reigning. Doesn't mean that. Until doesn't necessarily require that. If I say, the music was blaring from the time I got to the party until the time I left, I'm not saying they turned the music down when I left. What I'm doing is demarcating a period of time that's important, from the time I got there until the time I left, because for my purposes, that's the part of the story I care about. I don't care if they had the music on after I'm gone. Likewise, and St. Paul talks about Christ reigning until he's put all his enemies under his feet, he's focusing on a particular period of time. Well, the same thing is happening here. Remember, the passage says that Joseph knew her not until she'd born a son. And you say, well, if he's not trying to say that they had relations after that, why mention it at all? And here I just say something that maybe goes unnoticed. It's really weird that John MacArthur, in a Christmas homily, or a Christmas sermon, which is what you just heard, takes pot shots at Mary's perpetual virginity. That's weird. That's bizarre behavior. It's Christmas, and you're focusing on why you think Catholics are wrong about Mary's perpetual virginity. Matthew is not that small-minded. He's not that petty. He's not doing that. When he's telling the Christmas story, he's not saying, make sure you know they had sex after. That's not what's going on. And if you read it that way, you've just completely misread the text, because you've gotten so focused on trying to prove Catholics wrong, you've lost the ability to read the basic text. I'll show you what I mean. Matthew 24 to 25 says he doesn't know her until she'd born a son. Why specify that time period instead of any other? Because he tells you two verses before. All this took place to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and his name shall be called Emmanuel. In other words, for the prophecy of Isaiah 7 to be fulfilled, two things have to happen. Number one, Mary has to be a virgin at the time of the Annunciation. And number two, Mary has to be a virgin at the time she bears Jesus, at Christmas. It's not one or the other. It's both and. And so the reason Matthew tells you that they didn't have relations throughout the duration of the pregnancy is not to tell you anything about anything that happens after Christmas. It's to tell you that they fulfilled both halves of Isaiah 7. And he even tells you that's why he's telling you that. This is not me saying there's this part in the Old Testament. If you apply that, Matthew's the one telling you, if you want to make sense of this, read Isaiah 7, which says a virgin shall conceive and bear a child. So this is not, you can't make this whole case on the intel. Well, the other point John MacArthur makes, and I just want to address this, because Mary's response to the angel is a powerful indication of her virginity. It's weird that a virgin is conceiving a child, not just because virgins don't normally conceive children, but because this particular virgin was married before she bore, but also before she conceived. And so we wonder, why was she a virgin? And to understand the answer to that, you have to first know the standard Protestant case that she wasn't a virgin after Christmas is wrong. So as John MacArthur notes, there are places like Mark chapter 6 where we're told about the brothers of Jesus, like James and Joseph and Judas and Simon. But then also in the Gospel of Mark, we're told that James and Joseph have a different mother. While Mary, the mother of Jesus, is at the foot of the cross, there are women looking on from afar, among them, the mother of James and Joseph. So that's pretty good indication. If these brothers, so-called, have neither the same mother nor the same father as Jesus, they're not brothers in the way we would use that term. In Hebrew, there aren't a lot of complex relational terms back in the day. And so terms like uncle, nephew, cousin, all those, you'd regularly shorthand that to brother. And here, Mark is recounting a conversation that would have originally happened in Hebrew or Aramaic. And so he's accurately describing what people said. There are a bunch of references to the brothers of the Lord, and they can't be literal biological brothers. They're more extended relations. In the same way that there are a lot of New Testament references to Abraham, our father, and he's not literally their father. It's great, 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 great grandfather times like 21. And so that's what's happening in both cases. They're using a shorter form for both the vertical relationship, Abraham, and the horizontal relationship between Jesus and his brothers, rather than giving the really complicated, you know, second cousin once removed sort of term you might want. And then there's also positive evidence. In John chapter 19, Jesus entrusts his mother to the care of John, a non-relative. Now, that's huge. If he has biological brothers or sisters who are the sons and daughters of Mary, it is unthinkable that they're not taking care of their widowed mother who's just lost her eldest son. This is true under both Jewish and Christian morality. 1 Timothy 5, verse 8, if anyone does not provide for his relatives, and especially for his own family, he has disowned the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. When we talk about the Old Testament admonition in the Ten Commandments to honor their father and mother, the original sense is taking care of your parents in their old age. The Ten Commandments aren't primarily written for kids. They're written for adults. Kids aren't, you know, the primary adulterers. They're not the ones committing most of the crimes against the Ten Commandments. It's grown-ups. That includes honor thy father and mother. And one of the ways you honor them is caring for them in their old age. And the rabbis talk about this, by the way. And so the idea that Jesus's brothers and sisters are so disrespectful that they're going to break both Jewish and Christian morality here is just a silly kind of understanding, especially if John MacArthur's right. And there's a bunch of them. How has not one of them stepped up to do their basic moral duty as a child of Mary? Doesn't work. So John 19 is positive evidence that Mary does not have other children. But the so-called evidence in favor of it is just a misreading of the word intel, or just a misunderstanding of the way the New Testament uses the word brothers. So we're still left with that question. Why then is Mary still a virgin? I've already alluded to an answer, but I want to give another part of John MacArthur's answer that comes closer to being right.
The mystery of all of this is profound and confounding. And when it says down in verse 25 that he kept her a virgin until she gave birth to a son, I can fully understand that he wouldn't want to do anything to touch her. It was not legal to do that anyway, just because they hadn't had the marriage ceremony. But I think it would have been hard to imagine himself even putting a hand on such a set apart and anointed life chosen by God for such singular calling.
So as you can see, he doesn't understand the Jewish marriage law. He thinks they weren't allowed to have sex, and we have clear Jewish evidence to the contrary. We also have a lot of evidence, even from within Scripture, that no one seemed to think Jesus' birth was a scandal when they assumed Joseph was the father, right? Like, understand, if they knew Joseph wasn't the father of Jesus, there would have been a scandal. Both sides agree on that. But if Mary was an unwed mother, there should have been a scandal even with Joseph as the father, right? Like, if you're dating someone and you get pregnant by them, even if you have a shotgun wedding, there's still a scandal attached. And if that's what you think the Holy Family looked like to the outside observers, you're just wrong. The evidence doesn't point that way at all. MacArthur is wrong about this. But what he gets right is there's a good reason Joseph wouldn't want to approach Mary in this way. Now, that's only taking the evidence halfway, because it still hasn't answered, well, why was she a virgin before? So I'm going to give a better answer and then work back to where MacArthur has some actual insight that we can make use of. St. Augustine says that Mary's virginity was more pleasing to God on account of the fact that Jesus didn't shortchange their plans for a sexual marriage, but rather because he was conceived, chose it, already dedicated to God as that from which to be born. In other words, the virginity was not something the angel Gabriel thrust upon them, and which is why we have no evidence of Gabriel giving instructions. Nor was it that Joseph just got too scared for 9 months and then decided to have a sexual relationship with her after. Rather, Augustine says, when Mary says, "How shall this be, seeing I know not man?" she would only say that unless she had vowed herself already to God as a virgin. The only context in which it makes sense for a married woman to say, "I have no idea how I could have a child with my husband," is if they're not having sex. And the only explanation for why they wouldn't be having sex as a married couple is if she's made some higher promise to God. So you might say, well, why is Joseph in this? Well, because he's a good man. He's a just man. He's a righteous man, as Matthew 1 tells us. As Augustine says, because the habits of the Israelites as yet refused this, I'll get into that in a second, she was espoused to a just man who would not take from her by violence, but rather guard against violent persons, which she had already vowed. That Joseph is not trying to undermine Mary's pledge of virginity. He's trying to protect it. This is a culture in which it was very hard to be a single woman. It was very hard to be a widow. It was very hard to be a woman alone. This is why women were either under the auspices of their father or their husband, typically. It's why Jesus shows a tremendous compassion to the widows, like the widow of Nain, like his own mother at the cross. It's very hard in first century Palestine to be a woman without a husband. But Augustine goes on that even if she had said this only, how shall this take place? And not addressed, seeing I know not man, even if she hadn't added the why she was confused, we could have deduced that she must have something strange going on. She wouldn't have asked that question, how she would give birth to a son if she had married with the purpose of having sexual intercourse. So, some people are going to say, Joe, St. Augustine, you guys are being too anachronistic. This kind of thing was unheard of. It's not really true. In the Qumran scrolls and the Dead Sea Scrolls, we have references to girls making promises of virginity. Because there's a question of, well, does her father have any say in whether she can make this kind of promise or not? Because that's going to impact the whole family's future financial earnings and everything else and family ties and all this stuff. So this is a thing that's actually addressed. Likewise, we see in St. Paul, 1 Corinthians 7, he says he wants us to be free from anxieties. And he says the unmarried man is anxious about the affairs of the Lord, how to please the Lord. But the married man is anxious about worldly affairs, how to please his wife, and his interests are divided. And then he says the same thing for women. The unmarried woman or girl, literally it says virgin there, is anxious about the affairs of the Lord, how to be holy in body and spirit, but the married woman is anxious about worldly affairs, how to please her husband. So we have from St. Paul the idea that some of us are called to make these promises, seemingly, of virginity. And likewise, you see this in other places as well, both in the New Testament and in early Christian writings. There's a clear sense that some people are called to live as virgins. Revelation talks about this, and you can get into whether those are all metaphorical. Nevertheless, there's a clear veneration of virginity from the earliest days of Christianity. Now, where is this coming from? Well, it's seemingly it's coming from something in the Jewish soil, as it were. And Mary seems to be one of the fruits of that Jewish soil. So that hypothesis makes sense of the evidence. If Mary has made some kind of prior promise and Joseph knew about this, well, he's fine with it. He's, you know, in other words, one of the reasons many Protestants don't believe in the perpetual virginity of Mary, and I've heard this expressed numerous times, is they think it's somehow unjust to Joseph that he can't have sex with his wife. And if he had known that, he wouldn't have gotten married to her in the first place. This is a pretty degrading view of women in the first place. What if she'd gotten sick? What if some other reason they weren't able to have relations? You don't have an absolute right in marriage. But nevertheless, Augustine's point is, it's better that that wasn't the situation. It's better that Joseph didn't feel cheated, that he knew what he was getting into. And why do we know he knew what he was getting into? Because of Mary's response to the angel. Because that's the only thing that explains why she's a virgin at both points. That still leaves a question then. What's Joseph afraid of? So this is an area where I think we have, again, we have an idea. It's like, well, of course he's afraid. He's afraid his wife's cheated on him, or his betrothed, his fiancée, his girlfriend, whatever we think she is. Well, maybe. But there's another way of reading the evidence that I think does a good job, and I would argue a better job of accounting for it. Now, I want to highlight here, everything so far, I think, is on firmer ground. This is admittedly more speculative, but I think it's got a good case. And of all people, I think John MacArthur kind of makes this case. So why is St. Joseph afraid? Matthew 28, verse 5. On Easter Sunday, the angel says to the women, "Do not be afraid, for I know that you seek Jesus who was crucified." Now, why does the angel have to say that? Because angels are terrifying. And the natural response is to be afraid. And then a few verses later, they see the risen Lord, and he says to them, "Do not be afraid." Why does he have to say that? Because the risen Jesus is terrifying to see. Now, when we talk about that terrifying, that thing that's causing fear, they don't think the angel's bad. They don't think Jesus is bad. But there's still a sense of fear and awe that C.S. Lewis calls the numinous. In The Problem of Pain, he talks about it this way. He says, suppose you were told there was a tiger in the next room. You'd probably know that you were in danger and would probably feel fear. But if you're told there's a ghost in the next room and believed it, you would feel indeed what is often called fear, but of a different kind. It would not be based on the knowledge of danger, for no one is primarily afraid of what a ghost may do to him, but of the mere fact that it is a ghost, right? Like, even with little kids, if they know there's a ghost out there or something like this, they're going to be afraid. But if you ask, what are you afraid of specifically? Are you afraid the ghost is going to stab you? Like, what, is it going to bite you? Like, what exactly is the fear? Well, no, it's none of those things. Rather, as Lewis says, it is uncanny rather than dangerous. And the special kind of fear it excites may be called dread. With the uncanny, one has reached the fringes of the numinous. Now, suppose you were told simply there's a mighty spirit in the room. So not like a ghost where it might be evil, but just a mighty spirit, a good spirit in the room, believed it. Your feelings would then be even less like the mere fear of danger, but the disturbance would be profound. Here's the closest he gets to defining it. He says, you would feel wonder and a certain shrinking, a sense of inadequacy to cope with such a visitant and of prostration before it. And that this feeling may be described as awe, and the object which excites it as the numinous. Now, I think that is a good definition of, or a good explanation, I should say, of what it is that they're experiencing when they see angels, when they see the risen Lord, when they see these incredible holy visitants, as Lewis puts it. You have a sudden visitor and realize it's an angel, and you're in awe, and you're terrified, and you kind of forget what to even say or think. Now, with that in mind, I want you to consider St. Joseph's dream. As he considered this, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream, saying, "Joseph, son of David, do not fear." Now, you might expect it to say, "Do not fear because I'm an angel and I know I'm terrifying, but I have a message. I need you to calm down long enough to get the message. This happens to me all the time." He doesn't say that. He says, Joseph, son of David, do not fear to take Mary, your wife. For that which is conceived in her is of the Holy Spirit. She will bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. And as promised, this is the thing that I think John MacArthur comes pretty close to getting right. Like, Joseph doesn't have the numinous fear of the angel. He's got a numinous fear of his own wife. And so he's afraid to take her, again, not sexually, into his house. He's afraid to complete the Nisuin because this is an incredibly holy woman. This is the mother of the Messiah. What is he supposed to do in this situation? Here's John MacArthur.
We think about people who are engaged having a difficult time waiting until they're married to display their affection. I think Joseph must have felt like he needed to stay away from her because she was some kind of transcendent person beyond anything he could ever imagine himself to be worthy of. He is told that the child in her has been conceived by the Holy Spirit, the third member of the Trinity. He would know the Holy Spirit from the Old Testament, the Holy Spirit coming on people for all kinds of reasons in the Old Testament, bringing God's power and God's presence into a life. This is stunning, shocking. It's the same message that Mary heard back in Luke 1. The child will be produced by the Holy Spirit. This will be a holy child. This will be the Son of God. So Joseph is now trying to figure out just exactly how do I fit into that. Little wonder then that when the angel said, "Do not be afraid to take Mary as your wife," fear was the first reaction of Joseph. Stop being afraid. You can take her as your wife. She is not so transcendent. She is not so holy. She is not so elevated that she cannot be your wife. What has been conceived in her has been conceived by the Holy Spirit.
Now, I would quibble with the last part. I mean, Mary is extremely holy. She is this person. It makes sense to be in some fear, some awe of, given the role she has. She's bearing the second person of the Trinity bodily inside of her. And the idea that you're going to treat her in a kind of a flip way of like, oh, you know, she's just like anybody else, would be unthinkable. Would be unthinkable. And so Joseph is right to want to kind of back away. That's a normal, healthy, holy reaction. We're told he wants to do this because he's a just man in Matthew 1. He wants to divorce her quietly. He wants to put her away, to not put her to shame. When we say Joseph is a just man, we don't mean he's a legalist. We mean he's a good man who, like all the holy just, was awaiting the Messiah. Now, he hears tell that his wife, maybe the mother of the Messiah, they're not living together, and this puts him in a strange situation. Now, the only thing I'd add to what John MacArthur is saying, is there's more Old Testament context that shows kind of the level of holiness that we should have in mind. I'm going to give just one example. In 2 Samuel chapter 6, we're told in verse 2, David arose and went with the people who were with him from Baal, Judah, to bring up from there the Ark of God, which is called by the name of the Lord of hosts, who sits enthroned on the cherubim. Now, the Ark was the holiest thing in Israel because in it dwelt the presence of the living God. Now, that's not as cool as what's going on inside Mary's womb, but it's still really cool. And so David arose and went. He's in Baal, Judah, the hill country of Judah, and he's got the Ark of God. Verse 6, they're trying to move the Ark to Jerusalem, the new capital, and as they're going through the hill country, the Ark slips on the back of the oxen that are moving the cart. And a fellow by the name of Uzzah reaches out, and he touches the Ark to try to steady it, and he's struck dead. Now, that might seem like an overreaction, but you need to understand the Ark was so holy, no one could touch it. That's how holy it was. And so David and his men were not supposed to be moving it in the first place. David then reacts to this in verse 9. How can the Ark of the Lord come to me? Well, it can't right away. He needs to do things the right way. He needs to get the Levites. He needs to get the priests. He needs to actually have the proper procession and have those who are appointed with the task carefully bring the ark in. And so in verse 11, he remains where he's at, the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite, for 3 months. And the Lord blesses him and all his household. And then finally, after 3 months, they're able to move the ark into the capital. And we're told in verse 16 that King David was leaping and dancing before the Lord. Now, think about all of those details from this one story in 2 Samuel 6 about the movement of the ark into the hill country of Judah. What does it sound like in the New Testament? Well, it sounds an astonishing bit like the visitation. In Luke 1, Mary arose and went. Same language. She arose and went with haste. And where? The hill country, to a city of Judah. What does she do there? She goes to the house of Zechariah and Elizabeth. And Elizabeth hears the greeting of the babe heard the greeting of Mary. The babe leaped in her womb. Right? So just as David had leaped and danced before the ark, John the Baptist is now leaping in the womb before Mary and Jesus. And Elizabeth is filled with the Holy Spirit, and she exclaims with a loud cry, "Blessed are you among women, and blessed is the fruit of your womb." And then she says something really remarkable. "Why is this granted me that the mother of my Lord should come to me?" Now, that's more remarkable when you put it up next to the parallel passage in 2 Samuel 6. Because David said, "How can the ark of the Lord come to me?" So where David spoke of the ark of the Lord, Elizabeth now speaks of the mother of my Lord. And then Mary gives the Magnificat. And then in verse 56, we're told Mary remained with her about 3 months and returned home. But here again, the parallel is fascinating because in the parallel story, Luke 1:56, Mary remains for 3 months. 2 Samuel 6:11, the ark of the Lord remained 3 months. That's not a coincidence. And that leads to why Joseph would have sort of numinous fear. Remember what happened to Uzzah. Even though he's well-intentioned, he's struck dead because he touched the ark. Now, imagine learning that you're married to the Ark of the New Covenant, the bearer of not just the Shekinah glory, but God himself incarnate in the flesh is in the womb of your wife, and you don't think you'd have the reaction, "Maybe I should back away slowly"? If that isn't your reaction, you don't understand the holiness of God enough. And so Joseph's reaction is absolutely appropriate and fitting. So I think too often, we read this and think, oh, Joseph is suspecting her of adultery. And maybe, but I think it's an equally good, if not better, case to say, Joseph understands the Old Testament. He understands that his wife, who he knows has taken this vow of virginity, seems to be fulfilling this promise he knows about from Isaiah 7 because he knows Isaiah 7 is a faithful Jew. And so this is someone who believes in the idea of a virgin birth. And here's the wife he knows to be a virgin saying she's pregnant with the Messiah. The idea that she didn't convey any of this to him and he's just guessing based on, "Oh, I noticed she's got a little bit of a baby bump," seems unbelievable to me. They would have almost certainly spoken about this. And so if he knows Mary at all, if he understands who she is at all, then the idea that she might be the one the prophecy spoke of seems completely reasonable, just as it seems completely reasonable to all Christians today to assume that Mary really is the woman of Isaiah 7. And we don't know her the way Joseph did. So all that's to say, I think there's a good reason to believe that what Joseph is experiencing is a holy awe, that kind of fear, that kind of terror, that numinous sense, not kind of a cynical skepticism of his wife's fidelity. So I know there's a lot there, but just to recap, no, Mary was not an unwed mother. Unwed mothers do some amazing things. If you go through the genealogy of Jesus, you can find all kinds of complicated relationships that God does great things through. But the complicated relationship in the Holy Family is not because Mary's an unwed mother. Second, all of the kind of ideas about, well, the until just means they had a normal marriage after that, completely underestimates how radically different Joseph and Mary's relationship is, which shows clear signs of there already being something unusual about it where they're not planning on having sex. It misunderstands the way Jewish weddings worked. And it misunderstands something about, I think, the nature of the radical holiness. Remember John MacArthur's point that a sane St. Joseph isn't going to try to have sex with Mary when she's obviously set aside for God during those 9 months. He doesn't say it that way, but that's his point. But the same thing is true even after Christmas. Mary doesn't go back to just being Joe Schmo after Christmas Day. It's a mistake to assume that, you know, a mom's job ends on the birthday of the baby, right? She is still radically set apart as the mother of God. So I hope these things, kind of looking at the Christmas story in a different way than you've heard before, can help you have a greater appreciation of what's going on and a greater appreciation of the role that both Mary and Joseph play. The very last thing, if you want more on this, I have written a book looking at it kind of from Joseph's perspective, a short book called The Man Named Joseph, Guardian for Our Times. And so I encourage you, if you want to go check that out. Otherwise, I'd love to hear your thoughts in the comments below. And yeah, look forward to reading those. God bless you. Have a Merry Christmas.
Thank you for listening to Shameless Popery, a production of the Catholic Answers Podcast Network. Find more great shows by visiting catholicanswerspodcast.com or search Catholic Answers wherever you listen to podcasts.